Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is part 10 of the series on Messianic Apologetics, Defending the Faith. In this series, we are examining ways we can responsibly and biblically respond to those who would challenge your position that Yeshua is the promised Messiah. In our last episode, we began the process of working through the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. We looked at how the modern Jewish arguments state that the servant that is being identified at the end of chapter 52 is referring to the nation of Israel as a whole, and how verses 1 through 8 in chapter 53, according to this view, is the kings of the nations that are speaking to the nation of Israel. We then went through the flaws in that logic, and then we began our deep dive into the text of Isaiah chapter 53. In this episode, we will continue looking at exactly what Isaiah was saying in his 53rd chapter, and then in the follow-up episode to this one, we'll take a look at what some of the traditional Jewish sources have had to say about this chapter in particular. In our last episode, we got as far as verse 5 of chapter 53. In this episode, we'll begin with verse 6. Verse 6 of chapter 53 of Isaiah says, "All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but Adonai has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him." So if we go back to the concept that this is the kings of the nation speaking, there's some real logical conundrums to this verse. By saying that all of us like sheep have gone astray, it implies that the ones who are speaking were originally part of the flock. How could Gentile kings ever lay claim to being part of the flock of Israel? At what point did foreign nations belong to the fold? Are we to assume that the covenants that Adonai made with the nation of Israel somehow applies to all the nations as well? When were the nations ever considered part of Adonai's covenant people? So if we conclude then that those foreign nations were never part of the flock, how could they have ever gone astray? Going astray implies that they were at one time considered part of the nation that is being spoken of. That's contradictory with what we know to be true, specifically that Israel is special and treasured in the sight of Adonai. David spoke about the status of the nation of Israel in exactly these same terms in the Psalms. It says in Psalm chapter 95, verses 6 and 7, "Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before Adonai our Maker, for he is our Elohim, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand." This same sentiment is echoed 5 chapters later in Psalm chapter 100, verse 3, where it says, "Know that Adonai himself is Elohim. It is he who made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture." It's the nation of Israel that is definitively identified as being Adonai's flock. The nations are not included in that description. In order to be considered part of Adonai's flock, one has to be bought with a price and adopted into his flock and brought into his pasture. This doesn't apply to the nations, so clearly then this can't be the kings of the nations who are speaking here, because that makes no sense. So then, who would this be that is doing the speaking? Could it be that it's the nation of Israel that's the speaker here? Could it be that the entirety of chapter 53 is about the nation of Israel and its relationship with its Messiah? Could it be that speaking of "all of us like sheep have gone astray, each one has turned to his own way," is a more poetic way of saying, as it does in Judges chapter 17, verse 6, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes." Wouldn't it make sense then that if the nation of Israel had gone astray, that they were all doing their own will instead of doing Adonai's will, and that this type of behavior would be what leads to the iniquity that's mentioned? But we then see that Adonai causes our iniquity, the result of our straying and pursuing our own wills instead of his, to fall upon Messiah. This continues the theme that we discussed in our last episode. Verse 6 is essentially a repeat of verse 5, detailing how our sin, our transgression, our iniquity was all dealt with by Messiah standing in our place. Left to our own devices, we ignore Adonai and his standards, and instead, we pursue that which pleases our flesh. Despite our tendencies, however, Adonai, in his great goodness, takes the consequences of our behavior and lays it upon his Messiah instead of upon us. Verse 7 then goes on to describe how this one, upon whom all of our iniquity was placed, responded to that heavy weight. It says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth." Now let's dig a little into the Hebrew a bit more here in order to fully understand the significance of this verse. When we read the words, "he was oppressed," the Hebrew says, "nagas." This word means, essentially, to exert demanding pressure upon something. As an example, the first 5 times that it's used in Scripture all occur in Exodus and all in chapters 3 through 5. Each time it's used, this word nagas is describing the taskmasters that were oppressing the Hebrew slaves. Now, this should immediately cause some brain synapse firing here to take place. In the same way that the Egyptian taskmasters oppressed the Hebrew slaves, Yeshua was oppressed by our sin. During the Passover Seder, most Haggadahs speak about how we should identify with being set spiritually free from our sin and bondage, in the same way that the Hebrews were physically freed from their slavery in Egypt. That freedom came through the blood of a lamb applied to the doorposts of the homes of the children of Israel. Likewise, our freedom from sin comes through the Lamb who was slain since the foundation of the world. But that freedom doesn't come without a cost. The weight of our sin, our transgression, our iniquity literally oppressed Yeshua in the same way that the Egyptian taskmasters oppressed the Hebrew slaves. But unlike the Hebrew slaves, who cried out to Adonai, who then heard their cries and delivered them, Yeshua stayed silent. In his silence, he suffered for our sakes. Like a lamb that's led to slaughter, he did not open his mouth in protest. Yeshua was exploited and mistreated. With no regard for his dignity, he was denied a just trial, but instead was tried by a kangaroo court convened in the middle of the night, where he was spat upon, struck, and abused. Yet he remained silent. He never attempted to defend himself. He willingly took your punishment and didn't utter a single syllable in his defense, nor did he issue any complaint. Yeshua neither resisted arrest, nor did he rebel against the unfair, unjust treatment he was receiving at the hands of those who operated out of evil intentions. Although he was facing a charge that carried a sentence of death, he refused to defend himself. He didn't seek to protect his own life. He was only concerned with preserving your life. He submitted to suffering the injustice that rightfully belonged to us. Verse 8 then says, "By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due?" Yeshua was arrested on false premises and tried unjustly. The verdict of the trial was death, a cutting off out of the land of the living, not for his own guilt, but because he took upon himself the guilt of his people, the same ones who were unjustly sentencing him. Please take special note of the phrase, "for the transgression of my people." This is biblical language that always and every time refers to the nation of Israel. Ami, the Hebrew for "my people," is a direct reference to the children of Israel, and there's no way that the kings of the nations made this statement. Adonai says in Exodus chapter 3, verse 7, I have surely seen the affliction of Ami, my people, who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their nagas, their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. And again, it's recorded in Exodus chapter 6, verse 7, Then I will take you for Ami, my people, and I will be your Elohim. And you shall know that I am Adonai your Elohim, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And then again, in Exodus chapter 7, verse 16, You shall say to him, Adonai, the Elohim of the Hebrews sent me to you, saying, Let Ami, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. Now, I could go on for the next hour, quoting the 700 other times this word Ami occurs in the Tanakh. Adonai resoundingly refers to the nation of Israel as Ami, my people, over and over and over again throughout the scriptures. In fact, this word Ami occurs 25 times in the book of Isaiah alone, 19 of those times leading up to chapter 53, including verses like this one, Isaiah chapter 52, verse 6. Therefore, Ami, my people, shall know my name. Therefore, in the day, I am the one who is speaking, here I am. Those who have attempted to claim that it's the kings of the nations from the end of this same chapter, chapter 52, are the ones who were speaking in the first 8 verses of 53, they're asking us to suspend rational thought here. We're just supposed to believe that in chapter 53, these kings of the nations simply co-opt that word and use it to refer to themselves? All of a sudden, they're Ami, they're his people? This doesn't fit with the narrative of Scripture. It's the transgression of Ami, my people, that led to the death of Messiah. Yeshua died not for his own transgression, but for the transgression of Ami, his people. It is Ami, my people, who were due the punishment of death. That means it was our behavior that deserved the sentence of death. We deserve to be cut off from the land of the living. The stroke was due to us, but he stepped in instead and took it upon himself. The sentence of death was carried out, and Messiah took our death so that we might live. That is why chapter 53 continues in verse 9 to say this, His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Although he had done nothing wrong, he was executed as a criminal with other criminals. Yet he was buried in the tomb of the rich, a prestigious man, Yosef from Arimathea. This Yosef was a member of the Sanhedrin. Thus, he was a well-respected man. Was he there at the trial that was held in the middle of the night in which Yeshua was falsely accused? We don't know. Perhaps he was. And it was his guilt over not speaking out that drove him to offer up his costly tomb to be used for Yeshua's burial. Or it's possible that he wasn't there, and his generosity was an attempt to make amends on behalf of his brethren. Either way, it was this Yosef who not only offered the tomb in which Yeshua was buried, but he paid all the expenses associated with the burial, including the expense of the burial cloths and the spices that were used to embalm the body of Yeshua. In an ironic twist, after suffering the death of a criminal on behalf of his people so that they wouldn't have to suffer such humiliation, he's treated with dignity and honor in his burial, as if he were a member of a royal family, which, of course, is absolutely true. Verse 10, then, has some very interesting facets to it. It says this, But Adonai was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of Adonai will prosper in his hand. It's striking that the very same words that were used in verse 5, which we discussed in our previous episode, are repeated here in verse 10. The Hebrew reads in verse 10, V'yod hevave, and Adonai, chafetz, was delighted. Dako, as we discussed in the previous episode, this means to be broken or shattered emotionally. Hecheli, As also previously discussed in the last episode, this is the word halal, which indicates something that's been defiled or profaned. So when it reads in the Hebrew, V'yod-he-vav-he chafetz dako he-chali, this means literally, and Adonai was delighted to shatter his emotions and defile Messiah. Wow. What kind of cruel, sick, evil God would delight in treating someone that way? The one who took upon himself your pain, your suffering, your sin. He delighted to carry it on your behalf so that he could be reunited with you in his kingdom. How did he do so? By symbolically becoming the very thing that was required when we sin, a guilt offering. It says in verse 10, Im tasim asham nafsho, which is literally, when put, placed, or made, guilt offering, his soul. He placed his nefesh, his soul, as the guilt offering required by the Torah when guilt is accrued. Our guilt. By taking our place, the snuffing out of his nefesh, that which made Adam a living being, satisfied the requirement of the asham, the guilt offering. The cutting off of Messiah's nefesh was not an accident, nor was it unplanned. As stated in Revelation chapter 13, verse 8, Yeshua is the Lamb who was slain since the foundation of the world. This has always been the plan. This was not a plan B. Despite the stubbornness and the hardness of the hearts of his children, Adonai used them as priests presiding over the process of this asham, this guilt offering, which brought forgiveness of guilt not only for the people of Israel, but for the entire world. When there was an operating altar and tabernacle or temple, the goat that was sacrificed every year on Yom HaKippurim had to be reenacted every year, year after year, because the atonement of blood that that goat provided only lasts for 1 year. Unlike the sacrifice that takes place on Yom HaKippurim, the atonement provided by the sacrifice of Yeshua's nefesh removed our sin, our transgression, and our iniquity once and for all. This type of sacrifice had to be more than simply unblemished. It had to be absolutely perfect. Only Adonai himself could provide that type of perfect sacrifice, and he was delighted to do so. Now the next words in verse 10 take us in an interesting direction. It says there, he will see his offspring, he will prolong his days. Yeshua didn't have any children, but through his resurrection, he prolonged his days, for he arose unto eternity. When he arose from the dead, he presented himself to the Father as the first fruits offering, the first fruits of the resurrection. All those who will be resurrected unto new life in his kingdom are the offspring of his death, burial, and resurrection. As the first fruits of the resurrection, he was then the forerunner, paving the way for all who will arise from the tomb when the last trumpet is sounded. When we arise, we will join him in his kingdom. The fruit of his resurrection will fill the kingdom, and we will sing his praises for all eternity. This is the scene that is described in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, where it says, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. Can you imagine what it will be like to witness this when it happens? It's going to be incredible. To be a part of that great multitude, standing in his presence, witnessing the Lamb upon his throne, praising him with singing and waving branches. When we wave branches at Sukkot, it's a foreshadow of what we'll be doing in the kingdom. How wonderful it is to participate in that each year. I would like to encourage you to mentally picture Revelation chapter 7, verse 9 next year at Sukkot when you're waving branches before him. Moving on, we arrive at verse 11. Here it says, as a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities. Sometimes we experience what this verse means. There are some things that we can look back on and say, it was worth the pain. It was worth the sacrifice. It was worth the toil. That is exactly what's being described here in verse 11. Yeshua looks back at the suffering, the pain, the agony he experienced, and then he looks at you and says, it was worth every moment. His soul is satisfied after the torment because he sees the fruit that was produced through the pain. As a tzaddik, a righteous man who took upon himself the sins of the multitudes, he could take pleasure in seeing those multitudes declared righteous through his efforts. It was this very result, righteousness being assigned to the children of Adonai, that Isaiah saw in his visions. It's why he spoke about this moment so many times. As an example, in Isaiah chapter 46, verse 13, it says, I, Adonai, bring my righteousness. It is not far off. Utshuati, and my salvation will not delay. And I will grant Teshua, salvation in Zion, and my glory for Yisrael. And then again, in chapter 51, verse 5, that we read in our last episode, it says, my righteousness is near. Yishi, my salvation has gone forth, and my arms will judge the peoples. The coastlands will wait for me, and for my arm they will wait expectantly. And again, in Isaiah chapter 56, verse 1, thus says Adonai, preserve justice and do righteousness. For Yeshuati, my salvation, is about to come, Vitzidkati, and my righteousness to be revealed. Isaiah, the prophet who was seeing these things play out before him, attempted to explain these things as best as he could. We get to benefit from the hindsight to be able to look back and see how what he was describing came to fruition. He was simply attempting to communicate the incredible message of salvation that he was seeing, resulting in righteousness being assigned to the many who placed their faith in the Zeruah, the arm of Adonai. And that brings us to the final verse of chapter 53, verse 12, where it says, therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured himself out to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. This verse states that Messiah is to be given a portion, a bravim, with the great. This word rav, correctly translated here as great, is the word that is used when we hear the word rabbi. Rav is a word that's used over 400 times in the Tanakh, and it always denotes something that is great, magnificent, or a multitude. As an example, the first time it's used in Scripture is in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, where it says, then Adonai saw that the wickedness of man was rav, great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of its heart was only evil continually. Another example, Psalm chapter 31, verse 19. How rav, how great is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you, which you have wrought for those who take refuge in you before the sons of men. Now, for a little lesson in Hebrew, in the Hebrew language, when one takes a word and adds the letter yod on the end, it denotes personal possession. For instance, the Hebrew word for father is av. Add the letter yod on the end, and it becomes avi, my father. As we discussed a few minutes ago, the word for people in Hebrew is the word am. Add the letter yod to the end, and you get ami, my people. The Hebrew word for brother is ach. Add the letter yod on the end, and it becomes achi, my brother. I could go on, but I think you get the picture here. Now, if you take the Hebrew word for great, rav, and add the letter yod to the end of it, you get ravi, my great one. This is what the word rabbi means, my great one. Yeah, I'll let that sink in a bit. This is why Yeshua says what he does in Matthew chapter 23, in verses 2 through 8, where he says this: "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moshe. Therefore, do all that they tell you," referring to that which they are reading from the Torah in the synagogue. "Do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds. For they say things while they're reading from the Torah, and they do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men." And that is the key to understanding this passage. They do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the places of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher and you are all brothers. In this passage, Yeshua tells us not to be called my great one, because we have a great one, and he is more than simply a man. There are two great ironies to point out here. First, the Yod is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. In fact, it's this letter that Yeshua makes reference to when he says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 18, "For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter," the Yod, "or stroke shall pass from the Torah until all is accomplished." The first irony here occurs when you consider that it's the smallest letter, the itty-bitty little stroke of the Yod, that when added to the word Rav, great, it ends up causing egos to puff up and humility becomes a thing of the past. Can you imagine how arrogant you might become if someone were following you around, always referring to you as my great one? And all this comes to us via the smallest, most insignificant letter in the alphabet. Proof that it doesn't require much for us to grow arrogant. The second humorous irony here is that the one who is and was the greatest to ever walk the earth tells us not to be called my great one. If anyone deserves to be called my great one, it's he. Yet he admonishes us not to aspire to be considered great. In fact, he demonstrates by his own life the exact opposite. This is why we see him wash his disciples' feet in John chapter 13 at the Last Supper. It's also why he said this in Matthew chapter 20, verses 25 through 28. "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." It was said of Moshe in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, that he was the most humble man on the face of the earth. But Yeshua demonstrated far more humility when he, as Paul put it in Philippians chapter 2, "although he existed in the form of Elohim, did not regard equality with Elohim a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. For this reason also, Elohim highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Yeshua, every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Yeshua HaMashiach is Kurios, Lord, to the glory of Elohim the Father." If anyone had a reason to boast, to be prideful, to be arrogant, it was Yeshua. He was divine. Yet he stooped to meet us where we are, taking upon himself all the frailties and weaknesses we experience so that he could identify with our struggles, all so that he could carry all those weaknesses upon his own shoulders in order to set us free. What an example of love through humility. It is this humility that is behind his advice to his disciples when he uses the opportunity of attending a wedding to teach this lesson in Luke chapter 14, verses 7 through 11, where it says, "And he began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, 'When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will come to you and say, "Give your place to this man." And then in disgrace, you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, "Friend, move higher." Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." The principle being communicated here in this verse is that the one who seeks to keep his life will lose it, but the one who seeks to lose his life for Yeshua's sake will find eternal, abundantly joyful life. Now, I'll take a brief rabbit trail here to further illustrate this point. When I was younger and involved in youth ministry at a large church, I read a book that was very interesting. Having matured in my walk since then, I would never recommend this book to anyone, because it's rife with terrible theology. But there was this one little story from that book that has stayed with me for the last 20 years. The author paints a picture of a vision of heaven where the multitudes of worshipers are before the throne of Yeshua. Yeshua then calls one man up from among the crowd, and the crowd of millions of saints parts and allows this one man to approach the king. As he's walking forward, those who are being passed by this man ask, "Who this man is? Who is he?" As this man is making his way forward, all of heaven is then enlightened, as if through the process of watching a movie, about this man's life. He was abandoned at an early age by his abusive, drug-addicted parents. As a young boy, he learned to live on the streets. He never went to school past second or third grade. He was not a noble. He had not done any great evangelistic work. He was not an accomplished person. In fact, he lived and died in poverty on the streets. Yet this man was being brought up by Yeshua to the very front of the crowd of countless saints to take a place of honor. Upon reaching the front of the crowd and standing before King Messiah, Yeshua announces to everyone why this man was being honored. He states that he has given everyone a measure of grace. Some people are extended very large portions of grace. Others do not receive as much. This man, Yeshua explained, had less grace extended to him than virtually anyone else. He had to struggle, fight, and claw for mere existence his entire brief life. No one ever attempted to help him, and he was universally rejected by everyone he ever encountered. He had every reason to be bitter, hate-filled, angry, and violent toward others. Yet this man took the ridiculously small measure of grace he was afforded and used it to its fullest. While he had every reason to be mean to everyone around him, he instead always behaved toward others in kindness. Although the gospel had never been shared with this man, yet he found a way in the dark, cold alleys to cry out to Adonai and to seek his presence. Yeshua then stated that this man was being brought up in the sight of all present and honored because he had been an incredible steward with the small measure of grace that he had been given. According to the story, Yeshua then challenged the multitude before him by letting them know that many of them had barely used the great amounts of grace he had given to them. Yet, in his grace, he had still brought them into his kingdom. But this man had accomplished more with less than any of them had accomplished with much more. At that point in this story, the entire multitude breaks out in applause, honoring this humble, unassuming man. Now, while this story is completely fictional, it still always stuck with me. It's an excellent example of Luke chapter 14 coming to life. the humble was being exalted to the highest place of honor in front of everyone. This is a perfect illustration of the principle Yeshua himself espoused. This is what the prophet Isaiah was seeing when he penned these final words in chapter 53. Verse 12, once again, "Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors." Though Yeshua cast off deity and took the form of humble flesh, though he was despised and forsaken of men, though he was neither regarded nor esteemed, yet he took upon himself our griefs, our sorrows, our transgressions, and our iniquities. Though he was beaten, scourged, mistreated, abused, cheated, betrayed, unjustly sentenced, and brutally killed, yet he never spoke out to defend himself. Instead, he willingly and gladly suffered those things so that we might be able to join him in his kingdom. And now he has been exalted to the highest place, seated upon his throne at the right hand of the Father. The one who was humble, lowly, and forsaken has been brought up to the head of the table before all the wedding guests, and with great honor, he has been given the most valuable position at the wedding feast. He who humbled himself has been exalted. As we come to an end of this episode, may we be reminded of his example, lest we seek to exalt ourselves only to be humbled. May we follow Messiah and humble ourselves and allow him to be the one who exalts us. That's all for this episode. We'll see you for our next episode, where now that we've closely examined Isaiah chapter 53 in detail, we will look at the traditional Jewish commentaries about this chapter and discover what the Jewish sages through the centuries have said about this chapter. So tune in for our next episode to find out. Until then, shalom.